Accession number 15479, Reel 2.
Mr. Day, Reel 2. You were just saying about the motivation for being an instructor.
That's right, and it must be quite a difficult thing when they come to choose people to become instructors, and I don't quite know how they get around it. But that's besides the point. Generally speaking, the level of instruction was very good, I thought.
Was Canada a good place for the RAF to be?
Oh, yes, in many ways. The big problem, of course, with wartime UK was that there could be enemy activity and the weather. In the Empire training scheme, which could have been Canada or Rhodesia, South Africa, and places like that, the weather was rarely a problem, and of course there was no enemy action. So from those points of view, it was very good. The other side of the coin was, of course, that you came back to this country to go on operations, and you had no experience of UK weather. Or UK navigation. Navigation in Canada was the easiest thing possible, because the whole country is divided up into vast fields, and all the lines run north and south, or east and west. So you'll see a field, and you know whether you're going north or south. And being we were on the western edge of the prairies, and the landmarks were few and far between, but very obvious. If there was a road, it would be the only road for miles around, or a railway particularly, and a lake would be a vast thing, and that you could only have to look out the window, and there it was. It stood out, so it made navigation, map reading, very, very simple. Coming back to UK, of course, it was completely different.
What kind of reception did you get from the Canadians themselves?
That was a bit of a disappointment, because we'd heard all these stories about the wonderful hospitality that people had received, but we were 20 miles outside Calgary when we first went there, and confined to camp because of the quarantine. So we experienced no hospitality whatsoever. Eventually, when the quarantine was lifted, and we did go into Calgary, we were just as if we'd gone into any town in UK. We were just, although we were in uniform, it was we were not treated like the people who'd gone out in the first place were. The novelty had worn off, I think, by this time, and so we had to make our own amusements and entertainment. So I didn't experience any hospitality at all the entire time I was out there.
I noticed you were in different places in Canada, like Prince Edward Island.
Yes.
Did it vary very much from place to place?
Not really, no. Not in my experience, certainly.
Now, coming back to the war, it seems that you were quite some time before you actually got into the fighting.
Yes, this was the thing at that time, you see. The war had been going for 2 or 3 years, and the Air Force had this training scheme well organized, so there was a steady stream of people coming, so they could afford to give them a little bit more, a few more hours, and slow down the training, and give extra training. And so it all took longer to get on operations. You were hanging around a long time in Canada before you went to an EFTS. That would presumably be the same, you know, the normal length of time. Then you went to an SFTS. In my case, it was between Calgary and Edmonton, a place called Penhold. The nearest town was Red Deer, which they call a city, but in this country would hardly qualify as a town. And we used to go in fairly frequently, but as I say, we went in twos or threes and made our own entertainment. Not that there was anything to do there. It was a bit of a hick town in our estimation. And then got our wings, and in my case the next posting was to Prince Edward Island, which was a GR school, a General Reconnaissance School. And they said, you've got to be there in a week's time, and gave me a train warrant. So knowing that it would take 3 or 4 days to cross the country, that gave me 3 or 4 days to sort of look around. So I went up into the Rockies and went to Banff and saw Lake Louise and places like that, and then got on the train and went across, travelling then on a civilian train as a normal passenger. They gave us little vouchers for meals. I've still got some. Sort of like a dollar for dinner, and you handed this over when you went into the restaurant car. Coming westbound on a troop train, we'd send two people down to the mess car, and they'd come back to our compartment, and we'd eat out of this big sort of hamper that came up. But going eastbound, as I say, I was just like a normal passenger. And you'd go along to the restaurant car, quite civilized, and nice meals. Quite a nice experience. And then got to Charlottetown on Prince Edward Island, and did this reconnaissance course. It was mainly teaching you how to navigate. They said, whether you like it or not, you are now course of command, which was another disappointment. I'd already had one by being sent to a twin engine school instead of a fighter school, and now course of command. But I consoled myself. I thought, the last thing I'm going to do is go on flying boats. I'm going to go on bullfighters. And that'd be sort of the closest thing to fighters that I could get on. So with that sort of a consolation in my mind, sat through the school at Charlottetown, quite enjoyed it. We used to go out into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, ostensibly on submarine patrols. I even heard that some of the people on the coast, on previous courses, had the cheek to put up the Atlantic Star as a result of these so-called submarine patrols that we've been on. To my knowledge, nobody ever sighted a submarine, although there were plenty of reports of sighting submarines, which turned out to be whales, and came back to this country. Came back on the Queen Mary. I think there were something like 21,000 people on that boat. It was run by the Americans, all the running of the ship, although it was a Cunard vessel, was done by the Americans. The catering was American. And out of the 21,000, about 20,000 of them were American troops. You can imagine trying to cater for that lot. It was all done on a rotation system. The kitchens were at it 24 hours of the day, and there were meals being served throughout the 24 hours. But you would have a strict time, an allocation, two meals a day, that's all. And they were all the same. There wasn't a breakfast, lunch, dinner. It was two meals. There were cooked meals. Some of the stuff I couldn't stand, like sauerkraut and, you know, American dishes, frankfurters and stuff like that. But I, from memory, my two times were 5 in the morning and 5 at night. So you go along at 5 in the morning, join this queue, go through, get a meal, and you're in and out of the place in a quarter of an hour. And the rest of the time, you were just killing time. It took just over 4 days to come back, which was very fast, unescorted, both times. Westbound, we were unescorted, relying on our speed. Just make a, you know, a fast dash for it. They reckoned that no submarine could keep up with us. And of course there were lots of navigators on board as well, and by this time qualified navigators, and they were all trying to work out our course. We must have gone south. We went from New York. We boarded the Queen Mary at New York. We didn't see anything of New York. We went on a troop train, arrived late at night on the docks. They escorted us straight on board. Very few lights on board, and straight down below deck, and we didn't even see the New York skyline. And off we went, and we must have gone south. The navigators on board reckoned that we were close to Bermuda, and because it was very hot, complete contrast to when we were westbound with snow on the decks, and even snow coming down the ventilation shafts. As I say, the boat was built for the South American run for the Royal Mail Line, and now going eastbound, it was temperature was in the 80s. And again, we docked at Gourock and went to Harrogate. And went straight on leave. When we got back, we were then posted to South Cerny, which was what was called an AFU, an Advanced Flying Unit. Again, the Air Force took the attitude that they could spare the time and wanted people more qualified, so they were giving us the extra flying time on the Oxford, the airspeed Oxford, at these advanced flying units, and also giving us some blind flying training. So I was at Cirencester, or South Cerny as the station was called, for 2 or 3 months, I suppose. And then from there, all the time we were there, and we were looking at the notice boards where the postings were coming up. You know, they would ask for people who would go on this aircraft or that aircraft, assuring us all the time that it would have to be coastal command. So I was looking out for postings to a bullfighter squadron. And one of the notices that turned up was they wanted volunteers to go to British Overseas Airways Corporation. And nobody knew what it was. Now, if they'd said Imperial Airways, we'd have known. But in 1940, the name was changed, And we were completely ignorant of the fact that BOAC was what had been Imperial Airways. And everybody ignored that. They weren't interested. But after the war, when I did get into BOAC, I came across people who had gone at that stage. And they were now senior captains, and I was a first officer. Anyway, that's beside the point. Imagine my horror then when a posting did eventually come through, and it was to Bomber Command. I think it's almost true to say that there were only a couple of occasions in my entire Air Force flying that I was frightened. And this was the first time. Just to be told that I was going to Bomber Command, the first little pangs of fear went through my body, because it was at a time when the losses were extremely heavy. And it was just frightening to think that that's what I was destined for. Of course, as always happens, once you're absorbed in something, the fear goes, and that's how it happened subsequently. But I did have that horrible moment when I was first told, oh God, no, you know, I could see myself being shot out of the skies in no time at all. And I went to what was called OTU, Operational Training Unit, and that was at Silverstone, which of course now is the where the Grand Prix are held, and that was on Wellington's. And that's where we were met up with our crews, where we formed the crews. We were taken along to a hangar, and there must have been about 100 people there, I suppose, all different categories. There were navigators, bomb aimers, gunners, wireless operators, and you just, you know, a bit of a free-for-all. You just went around trying to make eye contact, trying to pick people out who you liked the look of, and formed your own crew. I was lucky, very lucky, with my navigator and wireless operator. They were both Australians and turned out to be absolutely first class. Two gunners, both Scots lads, one from Wick, forgotten where the other one came from, Kirkcudbright, I think, and a bomb aimer. And he, by this time, I was a sergeant. I forgot to mention earlier on when I was at SFTS and we got our wings. There was a rather unpleasant little episode there. We were gathered, and the commanding officer met us, and he said, oh, I've just got through from Ottawa. Who's going to be made an officer and who's going to be made a sergeant? This is the day after we'd got our wings. And he read the list out, and there were out of about 40 of us, I think, 30 or 40 of us, there were going to be 14 made commissioned. And I was the 13th name read out, and there was one other, the 14th. So I thought, oh, marvellous, you know, I'm going to be a pilot officer. Went back to my barracks, and an airman came along about 5 minutes later, and he said, he called my name out, and the 14th man, can't remember his name, he said, oh, the commanding officer wants to see you. So we went back, and the commanding officer said, oh, I'm very sorry about this, he said, but there's been a mistake. He said, I'm afraid you two are not going to be commissioned. and left it at that. What transpired was that we had two Royal Canadian Air Force people on our course, and they had not been commissioned. And when the RCAF found out, they said, no way, our men are going to be commissioned. And the only way to do it was to take us, to tell us that we were not going to get commissioned, and those, the Canadians got it. That left a rather nasty taste in my mouth. So here I was now at OTU as a sergeant, and all the people I was picking for my crew were sergeants, except for the bomb immer, the only man left at the end, which everybody else seemed to be avoiding, was this pilot officer, bomb immer. So we had the situation where there were seven crew members, sergeants, and one pilot officer as a bomb immer. But we all gelled, and we formed a very good crew, and carried on with our training. And then from OTU on Wellington's, we went to what was called a heavy conversion unit. And it was at the heavy conversion unit that we then got our flight engineers. We didn't have flight engineers at OTU because there wasn't a flight engineer station on Wellington. So the first aircraft that we had with a requirement for a flight engineer was the Stirling on heavy conversion units, and that's when they gave us a flight engineer. And so we converted heavy conversion on the Stirling, and from there on to what they call Lank Finishing School, where we were converted on the Lancasters, and from there to a squadron.
What did you think of the Lancaster to fly?
I didn't get on with it very well to start with. I'd been flying the Stirling, which had a reputation of being not a very good aircraft to fly. It couldn't fly very high for a start, and it was made by Short Brothers, and I think this was one of their first land planes. They'd always made seaplanes, and I don't think anybody in the design department knew how to build an undercarriage, because there was this aircraft, one of the biggest aircraft the Air Force ever had, with this enormous undercarriage to keep the propellers off the ground, obviously, and it was so long. So they were very, very long, and it was the weak point of the aircraft. If you landed in a crosswind, you were just as likely to wipe the whole thing off and land on your belly. But I discovered the secrets of landing a Stirling, and that was to come in a little bit faster and land it on the wheels, not to try and do what they call a three-point landing. A three-point landing is where you come in with your tail down and you land all three wheels, that's the main wheels and the tail wheel, all at once. And throughout our training, every aircraft at that time was a tailwheel aircraft, and so all the training was for three-point landings. But I discovered that the only way to get a really smooth landing on the Stirling was to touch down on the main wheels and then let the tailwheel come down. So when I got onto the Lancaster, I was trying to fly it the way I'd been flying the Stirling. I was really crashing the thing in. Oh, it took me a long time, but eventually the instructor was very patient with me, and I got the hang of it. And although I was still banging them in, he let me go off solo. And that was just about it. That's all you had to do at Lank Finishing School, was once you got to the solo stage, that was the end of your training. You know, you'd done all the navigation flights on the Stirling. You've done your cross countries, your fighter affiliation, your bombing, and all the rest of it. So you were fully operationally trained. And once you'd done your solo on the Lank Finishing School, straight on to a squadron. And then, of course, I got used to the Lank and absolutely loved it. It was a superb aircraft. And landings improved, and I was quite adept with it in the end. I was even complimented on several occasions by my fellow pilots, the way I used to land it. This was 50 Squadron, which was at Skellinthorpe. Skellinthorpe.
Is this Lincolnshire?
Yes. No more than 5 miles outside Lincoln, to the south of Lincoln. In fact, one of the runways was lined up, almost lined up, with the Lincoln Cathedral, the spires of Lincoln Cathedral, the towers of Lincoln Cathedral, which, as you know, is on a hill, so it was visible all the time from the airfield. In fact, I think I'm right in saying it was about the only place in the country that had an anti-collision beacon on it, which they used to light whenever we came back from operations or when we were taken off. It was obviously only put on for as short a period as possible, but it was certainly illuminated so that nobody would fly into it, because it was quite a prominent landmark on the flatness of Lincolnshire. And of course, the first thing that happened when I got to the Lang Finishing School was to be informed that it was now Air Force policy that every captain of aircraft would be an officer. So I was just told, you know, from now on you're an officer, you're a pilot officer. Given the usual cash allowance, went into the nearest town, which I think was Newark. That's from my Lang Finishing School. And kitted myself out with officer's uniform. So when I arrived at 50 Squadron, there were two of us commissioned, my bomb aimer and myself. And the first raid you did on a squadron was you took the place of a flight engineer on somebody else's crew, where you flew with an established crew, just you, just the captain of the aircraft, just for I've forgotten the official the wording of it, a look-see flight, I suppose you could call it, and that was at Brunswick. And I was just an observer, in every sense of the word. I didn't participate in anything. I was just there to look and watch and see how it was done. It was a night operation, and everything went normally. It was quite impressive, I must say, flying over the target and seeing all these marker beacons glowing from the bombs landing, and the I can still see it in my mind's eye. It was quite a sight. There is footage of Air Force raids, sometimes shown on television, and of a typical raid of a town being bombed, and that's exactly how it was.